Welcome. Today is Tuesday, September 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a suspect in multiple weekend bombings in New York and New Jersey is in custody.
A lot of technology involved in this, but a lot of good old-fashioned police work, too.
World leaders look for ways to deal with a growing refugee crisis.
The president is going to expand the United States' commitment.
Adopted from Sierra Leone as an infant, a young man looks to give back to his country. Also ahead, could the school teachers of the future be robots? It's all on today's International Edition. Well, a man sought by police in connection with the bombings in New York and New Jersey on Saturday is now in custody following what has been described as a shootout with police. Law enforcement officials say 28-year-old Ahmad Rouhani was detained in Linden, New Jersey, late Monday morning. President Obama, who was in New York for the United Nations General Assembly, praised police for apprehending the suspect so quickly.
It is outstanding police work, outstanding law enforcement work. I, in particular, want to give a heartfelt thanks to the New Jersey police officers who were able to apprehend this individual.
Monday's arrest came as investigators look for more clues to determine whether the bombings are linked to international terrorism. Assistant Federal Bureau of Investigation Director Bill Sweeney says at this point it does not appear Rouhani was part of a bigger operation or terror cell.
I have no indication that there is a cell operating in the area or in the city. The investigation is ongoing, so as we develop more information, we continue to go, but I have no indication that there is a cell operating here.
Both presidential candidates also reacted to the bombing, and as expected, both had very different reactions.
Congress should pass measures to ensure that foreign enemy combatants are treated as such. These are enemies, these are combatants, and we have to be tough and we have to be strong.
Launch an intelligence surge to help identify and thwart attacks before they can be carried out. We need to work more closely with Silicon Valley and other partners to counter terrorist propaganda and recruitment efforts online.
Well, let's dig deeper now into this with veteran reporter Jamie McIntyre, senior national security writer for the Washington Examiner. Thank you for being with us. Bring us up to speed now on the investigation.
Well, I think there were two things about this that were really sort of stood out. One of them was, thankfully, that despite the fact that this was a fairly powerful bomb that went off on 23rd Street in the Chelsea section of New York, no one was killed, and it appears that even the injuries are not life-threatening to anyone. So that was something. And then the other part of it was that they captured this guy so fast and that they captured him alive. And it turns out that they pretty much had a good idea who they were looking for fairly early on. Ahmad Khan Rouhani had been interviewed not for any sort of terrorist incident, but because for immigration purposes. His fingerprints were on file, and they were able to get fingerprints from the second explosive device that did not go off in another section of New York. Plus, he showed up clear as day on surveillance video. And, you know, these days, one of the things about pretty much anywhere in the United States, but particularly in Manhattan, is that there are surveillance cameras almost everywhere. So they had, of course, video of the explosion going off, but they also had a very clear picture of him. And that, combined with his fingerprints, meant that very early on, they knew exactly who they were looking for. They knew where he lived. They knew other people who knew him, and so they were able to zero in on him in a very, very short time.
Very impressive police work, for sure. Would you say that situations like what happened are pretty much the new norm, or are we not doing enough?
This is the nightmare scenario for counterterrorism officials, trying to stop somebody who looks like they may be flying under the radar. They're not on anybody's watch list as a possible terrorist. And then they may or may not have acted alone in this case. And it's very significant that he was captured alive, because that means they may be able to get quite a bit of information out of him. Now, he might not be willing to talk to authorities right away, but he's going to be in custody for a long time. And at some point, they're going to get some information out of him. You know, in so many of these recent incidents, the gunman or the attacker or the bomber ends up being killed either by law enforcement or killing themselves. And then the law enforcement is just limited to what they can get from their computer and text messages and what others around them might have thought. But they may be able to learn a lot more. And there's a couple of important unanswered questions. One is, did he really act alone or is he part of a terrorist cell? Right now, authorities are not looking actively for anyone else. This is, they believe, the one suspect that they were looking for. But that doesn't mean other people didn't help or weren't involved or had some sort of connection. So with him alive, they may be able to track that down. And it also means that they'll just be able to mine more intelligence from this and try to answer the other big unanswered question is, did he get help from overseas, from Afghanistan or Pakistan or some Islamic State group overseas? They have determined that he traveled to Afghanistan and Pakistan about 4 years ago, didn't really raise any particular questions at the time. He had family in Afghanistan, so it didn't seem unusual.
And we heard very differing reactions from the presidential candidates. One of them was very emotional, lots of bluster. The other one was sort of a more measured approach. What's your take on the candidates' reactions?
We did have two very different reactions. Donald Trump really doubled down on a couple of things. One is he just said, quote, "We have to get very tough over there." And when he was pressed on that, what does that mean? He just meant we're going to have to hit them very hard. One of the things that's difficult to figure out about Donald Trump's very sort of aggressive response is what it is he would actually do. Now, he has told us that he wants to double down, he says, on vetting of people coming to the United States. And he keeps talking about screening refugees. But in all of these terrorist incidents that we've had lately, these are not committed by refugees. These are committed, the ones in the United States, by U.S. citizens who've been here quite a long time. So unless he's talking about figuring out if somebody who comes here as a young child will eventually grow up and be radicalized, I'm not sure how that works. And of course, Hillary Clinton had sort of, she did talk about screening and vetting and also support for law enforcement, a much more traditional approach to battling this kind of terrorism. And this is, looks like the so-called lone wolf scenario, where somebody, they didn't come here from another country, they didn't necessarily even have training from some terrorist group. They grew up here and somehow got radicalized or somehow got motivated to commit these kinds of acts. So two very different responses, and each one is designed to appeal to the supporters of the particular candidate.
Right, and Donald Trump did on Fox News say that the police, that they know who these people are, but they're afraid because they're trying to be politically correct, and that, you know, he basically alluded to the fact that we should be profiling. Is that something that would actually be realistic to do in this country?
Well, you know, if you talk to law enforcement officials, they'll tell you that there's two different kinds of profiling. One of them is, you know, religious profiling or racial profiling, which they say is not effective and doesn't work and certainly goes against American values. That doesn't mean they say you can't profile people based on their activities. So, for instance, if somebody is traveling back and forth from an area where there are known terrorist training camps, or if they're purchasing supplies that could be used to make a bomb, or they're moving money around in a way that's suspicious. Those are kinds of things that law enforcement look for and that will, you know, prompt them to raise questions and perhaps talk to people. But, you know, one of the things that we've discovered, not just in this case, but in other cases, is, you know, you can go interview someone. You can ask them about their leanings. You can try to figure out if they're predisposed to commit some crime. But until they actually do something, it's impossible to know if someone is going to commit a crime, particularly if they have no criminal record. So there's a limit to what criminal profiling can do. And the racial profiling or religious profiling is something that we just don't think is something that's constitutional.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Thank you so much, Jamie McIntyre, senior national security writer for The Washington Examiner. And you can also sign up for his morning newsletter, available free in your email inbox every morning. Sign up at WashingtonExaminer.com/DOD. Now let's turn to what's trending online with International Edition's G. Abby Lee. She joins me in studio with what people are saying about the upcoming presidential debate, the explosion in Manhattan, and lots more. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori. The first presidential debate for the upcoming election is scheduled for a week from now, and of course, the online community is busy talking about the details. NBC's Lester Holt is the moderator for next Monday, and he announced the topics this Monday afternoon. They will be America's Direction, Achieving Prosperity, and Securing America. He's on Twitter at Lester Holt NBC, but he hasn't tweeted since late August. That's a long time.
It is a long time. So what about the New York explosion? What are people saying?
Many Twitter and Facebook users quoted New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who said, "We have every reason to believe this is an act of terror." Our national security correspondent Jeff Seldon is one of them, and he is on Twitter at jseldon. Pop singer Lady Gaga, who is a New Yorker herself, tweeted this: "In New York, safe and sound, saying big prayers for my friends in Chelsea. Everyone be safe. We New Yorkers always stick together." People are also talking about a Starbucks employee handing out free coffee to first responders after the explosion.
That's great. That's just like New Yorkers. They really do pull together. That's really cool.
Yeah.
It's nice to know there's still a little
positivity
happening in the midst of the chaos.
Absolutely.
So what else is trending?
Well, unless you've been living under a rock, you have heard of the Pokemon Go craze. But the latest trending story is a Pokemon Go Plus, with a trending hashtag being hashtag Pokemon Go Plus.
What's that?
It's a new device that you can wear to play Pokemon without having to use the app on your phone. So you can wear like a wristwatch using a strap that comes with it, or clip it onto the edges of your clothing or bag like, I don't know, a button. Some people are saying being able to play the game while your phone is locked is great for saving the phone's battery, but others argue it's just a notification device, so it should have been just a phone notification system, as opposed to something that you have to buy for $35. Back to you, Lori.
All right. Thanks so much, G. You can follow her online at G Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we are following online at voanews.com. Attack on an aid convoy in Syria may have destroyed the ceasefire deal. The feds seek to steer self-driving cars. Africans feel at home in a small Texas town. And Game of Thrones and Veep take top honors at the Emmys. Find expanded coverage of these stories and lots more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Well, as world leaders meet in New York at the United Nations for a high-level summit, member states have agreed to protect the rights and share responsibility for large amounts of people on a global scale. The international community pledging to improve its response to the global refugee and migration crisis, though some question whether the plan goes far enough. President Obama is pledging that the U.S. will do its part. Joining me now to talk about this, Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. He's also the author of The New Minority. Thank you for being with us. I understand you're actually in New York right now attending United Nations General Assembly events. What exactly is President Obama proposing?
The president is going to expand the United States' commitment to admitting new refugees into the future by increasing the annual flow of humanitarian migrants substantially. It's already moving from 70 to 80,000, 85,000 people per year, and it'll eventually go up to 100,000 refugees per year. However, that is truly a drop in the bucket when you think about the millions of people who have been displaced by wars in the Middle East, in various other parts of the world, that need home.
It would seem that there is a dialogue in the U.S. and Europe from some segments of the population that is vilifying immigrants, or maybe just being concerned about whether or not we are potentially letting in people that could do us harm.
You know, Lori, what's happening is that refugees are being associated with the war zones from which they're coming. And so when in fact, in reality, refugees are desperately trying to flee these war zones, it would be like blaming Jews for being the infiltrators of, or the persecutors in the Holocaust. That's what the equivalent would be. Refugees are fleeing danger. They are not the sources of danger. And that fundamental misunderstanding is, yes, driving a lot of their vilification and their villainization in the United States and abroad.
How do you think it will be received with the United Nations? Do you think that, world leaders will say, we are not doing enough? Will we get pushback? What do you expect?
Lori, you're going to hear a lot of effusive statements that things need to change, that countries need to do more, that more aid is needed, and that more funding is available to help refugees and their plight. However, there has been no firm commitment made by the United Nations or its member states to actually do more. There's going to be a lot of talk, but there's going to be very little walk.
What about the U.S.?
The United States is pointing to itself as a leader by accepting more refugees, which is definitely to be commended. But it is a small amount of refugees in the scheme of things relative to the size of our population. And it's also a small amount of refugees to be accepting, given the reality that the U.S. has had a very strong hand in creating the conflicts that are currently ravaging the Middle East. Now, that's not to say that the United States caused the Syrian civil war. It didn't. But various actions in that region, in the Levant and in Iraq, have certainly contributed to that instability, and many of the refugees are fleeing precisely that.
Given the circumstances that have occurred this week with terror attacks in New York and New Jersey, I would imagine you would hear a lot of pushback toward the president bringing refugees into this country.
There very well may be. You know, anytime you're bringing foreigners into a new country, there will be fears and xenophobia of what they bring with them. But I just think it's very important for people to understand that refugees are among the world's most vulnerable people. These are people who are fleeing persecution, famine, war, intense poverty, dangers to themselves and to their families. And they often come with young children, making them all the more vulnerable and sensitive to these horrors. They're victims of trauma, of torture, and they are truly, truly looking for a place to call home where they can just be safe. These are truly the most vulnerable people on earth. And for every single person who we can afford to give a home to and to embrace into our society, it is a good deed that will be valued by these people forever. So I think it's important to really interrogate the perceptions that we have of refugees. And that doesn't mean that you just accept as many as possible with open arms and no questions asked. Certainly the United States is obligated to vet refugees, which it does very thoroughly, perhaps more thoroughly than any other country in the world. And of course, you can't let everyone in because there's only so much space and societies can only handle so much demographic change at one time. But I think we can see the United States throughout its history has taken immigrants from really difficult situations, refugees from humanitarian nightmares. And the United States is stronger because of it.
Why has the outlook toward immigrants and refugees in this country, which we are a nation of immigrants, why has it changed so dramatically? Is it because of fear of terrorism?
I'm not sure that it has changed that much. You know, when we had an enormous amount of Catholic immigrants coming to the United States, there were rampant fears of papalism, people pledging allegiance to the Vatican rather than to Congress and the White House. When Jews were entering the United States, there's an enormous amount of anti-Semitism. Generally speaking, foreigners are not particularly welcome at any given moment in history. I do think that the specter of terrorism creates greater panic and greater fears. However, it's important to realize just how unfounded those fears are. More and more analyses of extremism show that it is not actually first-generation immigrants that are pursuing these attacks. It is often, in the case of Islamic extremism, it is often converts, and it is typically second and third generation immigrants. So it is certainly not the refugees who are to be blamed here, and I don't know of any refugee perpetrated attacks in the United States to this moment.
Justin Guest, Assistant Professor of Public Policy at George Mason University's Schar School of Policy and Government. Thank you for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else, right here on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. We now bring you an update on the story of Yusufu Bengura, a boy born during the height of the Civil War in Sierra Leone, given up for adoption in an orphanage, adopted by Americans, and then now setting out to rediscover his roots and bringing aid to the people of his country. Here for an update on his new organization's progress, Yusufu. Now, before we talk about the Bengura Project, refresh us on your story.
I was born in 1996 in Sierra Leone, West Africa, and during the Civil War. And during that time, my mother couldn't take care of me and my other brothers and sisters. So she decided to give us up for adoption to a family up here in Montana. And I've lived in Montana, grown up as the young man that I am. Back in high school, after the Ebola epidemic happened, it really hit me that I wanted to go back to my home country and see my family for the first time. So I took the initiative of working construction for about a year, saved up enough money, and then went back to go see my mom for the first time. But during my journey, I didn't even know if she was alive or not. So with the help of some friendly folks over here in Missoula, Montana, I was able to find her and track her down with the orphanage, the All Is Well agent. And when I did that, you know, that kind of brought joy to my heart. So that really compelled me to go back home to my home country and see my family for the first time.
I can't imagine what it must have felt like to see your mother for the very first time after, you know, being in an orphanage and then adopted in the U.S.
It was very bittersweet, but it was one of the best moments that I've ever felt in my life, just knowing that she was there and the person that gave me life was still alive. And so it really was a privilege and an honor to be able to do that. And I know many kids who are in the same situation or have been in the same situation have not had the same luck as I have. So I feel very privileged and honored to be able to do that.
This whole experience inspired you to start a nonprofit. Tell us about the nonprofit and where you are with that.
It was incorporated about 2 months ago, but we are going to be doing human-centered development, sustainable development for my home country. We're going to be starting in Cambia Village, where I was born originally and where my family is. And it's going to be allowing the people to choose what they want, using the resources that they have, and what kind of culture we can integrate into the nonprofit to create a more sustainable and better development program for them.
And I understand you're having a lot of success with it so far.
Yes. You know, a lot of people know my story out here in Missoula, Montana. So one of the people that actually heard about it was Dennis Washington, who is a billionaire here in the state of Montana. So his executive director decided to get in contact with him and see if he could help out. So he invited me to a conference, which happened a couple of days ago, with the Philanthropy Northwest members. And corporations come together like Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, J.P. Morgan Chase, Boeing, those big names. So I was able to be with them in that room, and it was a really great experience. So, you know, just get those connections, really just learn from what I can from them to put into my nonprofit and to form a better nonprofit over the long run, but also possibly get some funding for the future. So right now it's just I'm in the relationship building phase. I'm working with these people who are in these corporations to help me find better ways to help my people and create a better nonprofit. So I'm going to use their knowledge to my advantage and create a better way to help sustainable development in my home country.
All right. Yusufu Bengura, founder of the Bengura Project, working to help the people of Sierra Leone. Thanks so much. Well, a cute humanoid-looking robot is making its way into the droid customer service market. One day, that robot, known as Sandbot, could be a hotel concierge or even a classroom teacher. VOA's Deborah Block has details.
You are doing great.
The adorable robot looks really friendly cool. And, yes. As this promotional video shows, could be used in many places besides schools.
No. Do you need a charming salesperson? No problem. Do you want a good deal? Buy one shoe and get one shoe free. Welcome to our restaurant. What can I do for you, sir? Please choose from the menu on my screen.
Whoa!
Developed by the Chinese tech company Kihan.
Nice to meet you.
Sandbot can recognize faces and voices. It has front and rear cameras and a sensor to avoid collisions. The robot also has special touch sensors, so if you squeeze its hand, you will get a response. The robot can be controlled manually or by using personal mobile devices. Sandbot is already being used in China as a warehouse guard and is helping travelers at an airport.
In the airport, it can offer the flight information for the tourist and also can guide them to the way they want in the airport.
Kihan has a public programming tool that can be used to create even more roles for Sandbot in the service industry. Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that wraps up this edition of International Edition, but you can find us anytime online at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Charles Hall. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world's fisheries are a natural resource that provides employment for over 300 million people and food for billions. Worldwide, fisheries support a $250 billion global economy. Yet, despite their great importance, fisheries' health and sustainability are increasingly under threat. That's because illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, or IUU, is enormously profitable, raking in billions of dollars globally. And that's a huge problem, because IUU fishing is a major environmental problem and an economic challenge. Such fishing undermines efforts to conserve and manage our fish stocks. Poachers and illegal fishermen take fish that could be caught and sold by local fishermen. They pay no taxes or license fees, so they can sell their fish cheaper, undercutting legal fishermen. They ignore fishing limits, fishing bans, and protected areas that are meant to maintain fish populations at sustainable levels, and too often use destructive fishing methods. Indeed, over the years, we have seen how large-scale IUU fishing operations can drive down populations of some of the world's most lucrative fisheries to dangerously low levels. One of the ways we can stop illegal fishing is to deny poachers access to markets. Tracking the seafood entering these markets is an effective way to begin. So, in mid-September, the U.S. Agency for International Development Oceans and Fisheries Partnership, or USAID Oceans, and Seafood Watch, an influential, sustainable advisory organization run by the Monterey Bay Aquarium, have launched a new partnership aimed at increasing sustainable fisheries management in the Asia-Pacific region. The partnership will improve and extend digital documentation and traceability systems in seafood supply chains globally. It will also strengthen Seafood Watch's engagement with industry associations, fisheries, and NGOs in Southeast Asia, and provide solutions and recommendations on traceability and sustainable fisheries for North American businesses regarding responsible seafood sourcing and purchasing. Together, said Jennifer Dianto-Kemmerly, Director of Global Fisheries and Aquaculture for the nonprofit Monterey Bay Aquarium, this partnership will harness technical experts, major seafood business partners, and on-the-ground producers to bring about dramatic and positive changes in Southeast Asia's seafood supply chain and serve as a model of collaboration for other regions around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is for